Hello, and welcome back to KHN's What the Health. I'm your host, Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent at Kaiser Health News. I'm joined by some of the best and smartest health reporters in Washington. We're here to bring you the latest in news about health policy from the White House, Capitol Hill, federal agencies, and the states. Although today we have something a bit different. We'll be answering your questions. We're taping at our usual time this week on Thursday, August 23rd at 10:30 a.m. As always, news can happen fast and things might have changed by the time you hear this, although this week I hope not. So here we go. Today we are joined by Margo Sanger-Katz of the New York Times.
Good morning.
Joanne Cannon of Politico.
Hello, everybody.
And Anna Edney of Bloomberg News.
Hello.
So first of all, thank you all who wrote or messaged for your most excellent questions. We couldn't use them all, but I'm holding on to the rest for when we do this again, and we will do this again. Here's how we're going to do this. I'm going to read the questions, and we all get a chance to answer them briefly, please, though some may take a bit to explain. At the end of the show, as usual, we will do our extra credits. So let's dig in. Here's question one. It's from Rachel Doherty of Clovis, California. She wants to know why dental insurance isn't part of medical insurance. Joanne, you want to take a shot at this?
Well, when I think Medicare was really sort of an acute hospital-focused program originally, and dental insurance wasn't really common before, and Medicare was modeled in part of the existing commercial insurance. I also, it's expensive. I mean, it's not as expensive then as it is now, but, you know, they were trying to keep things under a certain dollar amount and that added cost. I also think that, you know, 50, 60 years ago, we thought of teeth as more of a cosmetic issue, and we now think of it as oral health, but we still don't cover it very well. Kids get covered in Medicaid and kids get covered in the ACA, but adults really have gaps.
Kids dental care.
Now, yeah.
Yeah.
But adults don't. There's still a lot of gaps.
But, I mean, traditionally, this just, I mean,
it's money.
Yeah. At the time, that's what the insurance packages didn't by and large cover dental care, and so neither did.
It's still an add-on. I mean, you have most of us have a separate dental program.
I feel like it reflects this strange history where, you know, dentists are not trained at traditional medical schools. They go to separate dental schools.
Teeth school.
You know, if you go to the emergency room, if you have a problem with any part of your body besides your teeth, you probably will get treated for it. If you have a problem with your teeth, which is a very common reason why people go to emergency rooms, they will essentially, you know, give you an antibiotic and refer you to a dentist. It's this weird history where dental medicine actually sort of came up as a separate branch of medicine from the whole rest of the body, and it has stayed separate in all of these different institutions, and insurance is one reflection of that.
A lot of that, there was something I covered as a local reporter long, long ago. I did a story on the local prison barber who was getting an award. And in looking into kind of the history of barbers, I found out that they were actually dentists, essentially. You know, so it wasn't, like you said, the medical profession. It was more done in the barbershop. It was sort of an add-on there as, you know, get a shave and get the tooth pulled that's been bothering you or something along those lines. So you see the red and white stripe, and that was sort of more for the rags soaked in blood for doing the dental work.
So while we are talking about things that are covered and not, we have two Medicaid questions, both also about historical things. The first is from Cameron Gilbard from Phoenix, Arizona. She wants to know why children are defined as under the age of 21 rather than 18 in Medicare's EPSTD program. First of all, Medicaid's EPSTD program stands for Early and Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment. It is a program that was actually started in 1967, 2 years after Medicaid, to basically help kids get care and help kids get particularly preventive care. We were just talking about dental care. This actually, the EPSDD program came about because there was a famous 1962 study that found that half of the men drafted for the military that year could not serve because of medical problems, and most of them were medical problems that could have been prevented if they had gotten appropriate medical care, preventive care when they were much younger. And that was literally the origin of EPSDT. The 21 rather than 18 is because that was actually the end age of welfare at the time. The Aid to Families with Dependent Children program, kids were eligible up to age 21. That was later lowered to 18. But in Medicaid, actually, I think now it goes to 19 in general. But that was the origin of why it was 21. So that's that question. The second question is from Ariel Levin Becker from Cheshire, Connecticut. She also has a historical coverage question. Why does Medicaid cover long-term care as opposed to Medicare or even a separate form of coverage? Joanne, you've looked at this a lot.
Well, this is a multi-part answer. I'm going to try to get it through quickly. As I mentioned a minute ago, Medicare was really pretty hospital-focused, acute care-focused. And that's really how people died in the 60s when Medicare was created. We didn't live as long, and we didn't have all these chronic diseases. There wasn't as much dementia because people didn't live as long to get dementia. So there was less of a long-term care need, less of a long-term care industry, which I'll come back to in a second. So it wasn't the focus of Medicare. And also remember, Medicare wasn't means-tested. Medicare was for everybody. To the extent that we were helping people pay for long-term care at that point, we were only doing it for poor people, which is true today. There was actually a precursor to Medicaid. There was a much smaller, much more limited, but it looks like Medicaid. It was a state-federal program. It did help poor elderly people. It helped blind people. There was a small long-term care component for that. So when we went from that to what we now know as Medicaid, nursing home care, long-term care, later home and community-based care came into Medicaid. But the other thing is, it was interesting, there really wasn't much of a nursing home industry at that point, and we didn't have a way of paying for it. Well, lo and behold, once we came up with a way of paying for it, at least paying for it for some people in 1965 in Medicaid, what do you know? We had a much bigger long-term care industry once we had money for it. But also
something that has been true in healthcare all
along. Yeah,
it's
either a vicious or virtuous cycle, depending on whether you're writing the check or getting it. And the other thing is, you know, our demographics have changed. If you were 65 years old in 1965 when Medicare and Medicaid were passed, you had actually been born in 1900, and our life expectancy for a white male in 1900 was 47. So we didn't live as long. If you were 65 in 1965, you did have a life expectancy to live quite a bit longer. Our families were different, right? We did more home care. So it's multiple reasons, but the basic reason is we actually sort of had a little bit of a program in Medicaid's antecedent, and it stayed there. And we still haven't solved it. It is the unfixed entitlement. It is the unfixed family burden. I mean, Medicaid only pay, you have to spend down all your money before you get onto Medicaid. We tried to tackle a little tiny bit of it in the Class Act and the Affordable Care Act, and you know that got repealed immediately. We don't know how to do this yet.
All right. Well, next topic, single-payer health care. We also have two questions. First, Bill Yackel of Sacramento, California wants to know, quote, what happens to the shareholders in health insurance companies if single-payer is enacted? Does the government buy their shares? What happens if a single state, such as New York, enacts single-payer that results in less income to the health insurance company? So this is a good question about sort of the potential pitfalls in the transition. Has anybody even looked at what might happen to the private industry?
This is totally a political choice. So there's nothing inherent in single payer that says a single thing about the shareholders of healthcare industry companies. But in general, I would say the people who are writing these bills, who are making these political choices, are not remotely concerned about this problem. I've looked at a lot of these proposals, both white papers and legislation that's come, you know, before Congress and before states, and this is just not something that you see. There is a related thing that you do see in some of these bills, and I believe the Sanders single-payer bill includes this, which is a concern not about the shareholders of for-profit companies in the healthcare industry that will take a haircut, but a concern about the employees of the health insurance industry that will essentially be put out of business. So some of these bills do create some kind of transition for those people, whether it's money or job training or other kinds of things. I think there's a recognition that if you're going to put a whole industry out of business, that's going to hurt not just the owners of that company, but also a lot of just ordinary working people who are, you know, insurance claims adjusters or secretaries or do other things at those companies. But I would say in general, if you're a shareholder of a health insurer or a pharmaceutical company or a for-profit hospital company, and we impose single payer and those companies become less profitable, probably that's just going to come out of your pocket.
Also along those lines, David Henderson of Raleigh, North Carolina, has a question about Medicare for All. He said, in response to Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii tweeting support for Medicare All, quote, I read the replies and easily more than half the ones arguing against it were saying Medicare is bankrupt. What's the origin of this narrative? Anna.
So this typically comes from about every spring, you'll see a report, at least us health wonks, we'll see a report come out from...
Social Security wonks, too.
Right, that's true. Social Security wonks as well, from the Medicare trustees and... Medicare and Social Security trustees, and they're the ones who are supposed to look at this trust fund. It's basically the fund that, you know, it's what funds Medicare and Social Security. So these are the Treasury Secretary, the Health and Human Services Secretary, Labor, and the Social Security Administration. So they take a look at the projections for how much, you know, money is left. When will this fund be exhausted? And so this year, in June, the report said it would be exhausted in 2026. And that's 3 years earlier than was last projected the year before. And this is a number that fluctuates on many things, on legislation and policy that's being implemented. So last year they said, or in June they said, it was in part 3 years earlier because of the tax law. So essentially, the government would be collecting less in income taxes than it had been before. And also that there had been lower wages. And so there would be lower payroll taxes as well. And then at the same time, hospitals, because the Republicans had repealed the individual mandate in Obamacare, hospitals were going to have a higher level of uncompensated care, meaning they'd be looking to Medicare to make up for some of that. And so Medicare would probably be paying higher fees to hospitals as well. And so that all things like that all kind of go into this projection that you see every year. In 2015, so this was kind of after Obamacare was implemented and really getting underway. The number was 2030. And so, you know, you can see kind of a difference like that. And it goes up a year, down a year, or a couple years, kind of every single time this report comes out.
And this is Medicare Part A. This is the trust fund.
Say.
I mean, everything Anna said is right, but it's important that people understand that Medicare has A, B, C, and D.
But the main parts are A and B.
Right. And A is basically, simply stated, it's mostly inpatient care. It's the hospital fund. It pays for a few other things, but you can think of it as paying the hospital bills. That is the part that comes out of this trust fund, which is, you know, always going broke sooner or later. I was just curious last night. I looked up the history of the trust funds, and they didn't even have one the first few years of Medicare. They weren't. So then somebody said, oh, I guess we better figure out what this thing costs. And 1970 was the first trust fund report, at least the first one I found Googling. And at that point in 1970, it was about to go broke in 1972. So, you know, you've had immediate 2, 3, 4 years. You've had 10 or 15 years. When it gets close, and we've seen this happen many times, Congress fixes it. They change the payroll tax. They come up with an inpatient payment system. The big one was the Balanced Budget Act in 1998, changed a lot of things. So it's fixable, but you do have to want to fix it, and you do have to have bipartisanship to fix it. And we do not have like a ton of bipartisanship now. But will Congress let Medicare go broke? No. Do I know how Congress is going to fix it? No, but no, Medicare is not going.
Yeah, and this actually,
Medicare is not going broke more than it hasn't always been going broke.
This is sort of the part that people don't understand, because this was part of the original compromise that created Medicare and Medicaid in the first place. Is that the Medicare Part A, the hospital and the Medicare small nursing home benefit, are funded by the payroll tax, by the Medicare payroll tax, which is the Medicare part of the Social Security tax, and it can theoretically go broke if taxes aren't enough to cover the cost. Part B, which is all of the outpatient stuff and now sort of everything else, are funded by general revenue, so they can't go broke. Part B is there have been some efforts along the years to try and rein in the cost of Part B and put some caps on it, and it's never
means tested.
Yeah, and yes, well, and people with higher incomes do pay higher Part B premiums and higher Part D premiums for their drugs, but in general, the only part of Medicare that can go bankrupt is the Part A trust fund, and so that's what we're talking about.
And when people talk about, you know, I've paid into Medicare all my life, that's what they're talking about. So there's a special payroll tax. You know, if you look at your paycheck, you'll see there's like a special line, and that's for a Medicare payroll tax that goes into the trust fund, and then all of the hospital bills that Medicare has to pay come out of that money. So it's like a little bit of a fiction. It's like an accounting gimmick. It's a way of saying, like, we're going to pretend that this portion of money in the federal budget goes into Medicare, and that this amount of Medicare spending comes out of this fund, really all the money is kind of mixed together in a giant pool.
Box.
And
yeah, not a lockbox.
And, you know, there are other, as Julie said, there are other parts of Medicare that are just paid out of the general fund and no one is really concerned about the in and out. But I think the fact that Medicare is perpetually going broke is a good reminder that even though it is true that people are paying into Medicare all of their lives, the amount of taxes that a typical person pays into Medicare during their working life does not come close to covering the total cost of care that Medicare provides to them. It's really a fraction. And the system sort of depends on there being a lot of other people who are paying in to help supplement your expenses when you need them. You're not, there's not an individual account for you that you're putting money into and then get spent later. It's sort of everyone, as their social duty, pays some contribution to Medicare, and then the assumption is that there will be enough money left over at the end so that when you get sick, it will pay for your hospital bills.
Yeah, the notion that you're prepaying your Medicare is not actually
It's not like
true.
You're putting money on an, you know, on a debit card.
Right.
But, I mean, the fiscal problems are real and the demographic problems are real. It's not that they're not problems that Congress doesn't have to address. They do. But it's not suddenly going broke in a way that we haven't
and
experienced
before. Even in 2026, when the Medicare trustees say that the fund will be exhausted, even then, Medicare is not broke in the way that we think of it, because there still are a lot of us who pay these payroll taxes who are going to continue to pay into the system. Essentially, what happens at that time is that there's no extra money in the pot. There's some coming in and then there are more bills going out than there are is money coming in. So that will be a problem for Medicare because it will only be able to pay a fraction of its bills.
Although I think that the first year is like 75%.
But yeah, it sort of takes a while for that to become a total crisis.
All right. Well, moving on, we were going to talk about a podcast favorite, drug prices. We have Barry Leibovich from Basking Ridge, New Jersey, wants to know about the interaction between payers, PBMs, and drug manufacturers. Don't we all? He's particularly interested in how rebates and clawbacks work. We have talked about this before, but Anna, you're our drug price expert. Why don't you give us a very brief summary?
So
that would be easy.
Right.
Nine-part series. Right?
So the pharmacy benefit managers are sort of what we call the middlemen, and they work on behalf of insurers or employers, and they negotiate with the drug companies to try and get a rebate. So the idea is the drug company sets a list price, and then they try to negotiate off of this list price, and so they would get a rebate, kind of something they get after it's paid for, something they get back, sort of like...
Sort of the opposite of a discount.
Right. Well, you know, I think of this like when I buy... I feel like this happened in the past when you bought electronics often. You like write in for this $50 rebate that you mail away for. It's kind of like along those lines. And so they... The problem has been, you know, these started getting a ton of attention. There was some attention back in 2011 with these rebates when CVS started excluding some drugs from its formulary. About, you know, a formulary is the list of drugs that we'll cover. There were about 30 of those. And then really, I think it picked up in 2014, 2015, when you had these very high-priced hepatitis C drugs. And so The big pharmacy benefit managers came out and said, we're only going to cover one or the other. These were made by AbbVie and Gilead. And so, you know, they
cost
them
like $80,000 for a course of treatment.
It was $84,000 for a course of treatment. So,
which at that point we thought was a whole lot of money.
Right. Yeah. now it seems not so bad. And so they, you know, by doing that, they were able to pay far less than the $84,000 in the end. But the problem is, as Joanne just alluded to, is now we have drug prices just getting higher and higher, and you have these bigger price tags coming along with them. And so the thinking is that these rebates are keeping the drug prices high, essentially, because the pharmacy benefit managers can take the rebates and, if they want, keep a portion of them, and some of them can go to the insurance plan to possibly bring down premiums. And so... That's sort of seen as a disincentive to the drug makers to bring the prices down. The clawbacks work where, you know, it's possible to go to the pharmacy and get a drug that you'll pay a copay for. Let's say it's a specialty drug. It's on a high tier on the formulary. You're paying $40, you know, or something, $90 for your copay, but the drug doesn't cost that much to actually get. but you pay that amount. And so the pharmacy benefit manager claws back all of that leftover money, the spread on that. And that's really been seen as unfair. And that's something that's actually been the subject of some lawsuits recently. It's not clear yet how exactly they're going to play out and whether there'll be sort of a trend there. But there's definitely a movement to try to look at pharmacy benefit managers maybe more as fiduciaries, more having to look. The Trump administration put out a blueprint to lower drug prices in May. And it said, you know, it suggested looking into that, which would mean that the pharmacy benefit managers have to put the customer's interests first, not their own, to get paid, essentially. Obviously, the industry does not like this idea at all.
Well, we will have much more on drug prices as we go. But now we have a question about something we don't talk about that much, but probably should: telemedicine. It's from Jay Cusha from Clinton, Mississippi. He wants to know basically why there isn't more, quote, progress and publicity on telehealth. Is there something I'm missing? Joanne, you've looked at telehealth a lot. Why isn't it catching on more?
Well, it is catching on more, but it's uneven because we don't have great ways of paying for it.
We should talk about what it is.
It's either just on the telephone or using a computer or a Skype kind of secure thing or you know, office visits instead of in-person visits. It has a huge amount of potential, particularly in rural areas or if you don't have a specialty or if you're homebound and can't get to the doctor easily. I mean, you're not going to do heart surgery by telemedicine, but you might do a follow-up visit after your heart surgery. Doctor looks at you, you look at the doctor and chat a bit and you're okay. We didn't have great ways of paying for it. We still don't have great ways of paying for it, but as the payment system in healthcare goes from free for service to more, there are a whole lot of alternatives where kinds of lump funds and new formulas. It is beginning to, I'm not sure if it's a foothold or a toehold, but and some state Medicaid programs, some of the managed care Medicaid programs are using it. And they're using, you know, it's not, we're not sure it's a money saver. There was one study that came out that said it actually raises prices because, you know, if you're sort of sickish, but you know, not emergency department kind of sick, and are you going to drag yourself to the doctor? You're going to sleep through it. Well, it might be easier just to Skype the doctor because that's, you know, it's cold and wet outside and you're feeling lousy. But so, you know, are there actually going to be more visits? There are.
It's like the nursing homes. If you pay for it, they will come.
Right. So there are some questions about, you know, is it a money saver or not? I don't think we know. I think it might be raised in cost in some places and not in others. But you know, like with mental health, there's some Medicaid plans using it with mental health where we do have a shortage of providers. And, you know, and we also don't know how well it's going to work. You know, is that good enough? Do you really need to be in the room with somebody? Or if being in the room with somebody is not possible because of where you live, you know, this may, you know, I think it will, I think you'll see more and more of it. The Kaiser Permanente system uses it a lot. They've been using it for years. They use it, I think, every doctor communicates. They really had a culture shift, and because they're paid, they're not fee for service. I did a panel with them maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I was surprised then how pervasive it is. They use it, you know, you're worried about your kid, and you know, the pediatrician Skypes the kid and, you know, tells you, I'm not looking so good, better come in or call me tomorrow. I think it's okay. So they're using it for a lot of communication.
All right. Well, speaking of things that may or may not save money, we have a wellness question. It's from Gustavo Corral from New York City. He points out that the ACA allows health plans to set aside up to 30% of health premiums as a reward or incentive to workers to participate in a variety of what's deemed healthy behaviors, everything from getting a health screening to losing weight or quitting tobacco. Quote, has this idea gone anywhere? He asks, is this just another part of the ACA that never got off the ground? Margo, I think you've written the most about this among those of us at the table.
So I'm fascinated by this because I think that wellness seems like the sort of thing that's a win-win, which is so rare in healthcare. The idea that if you give people incentives to take better care of themselves, they will take better care of themselves, and it will also lower the cost of their healthcare. And I think if that was true, it would be wonderful. So two things. One is that this has, in fact, caught on. It's become more and more popular among large employers. The Kaiser Family Foundation puts out a study every year where they look at health benefits sort of across the country. And what they say is that about more than half of large employers have some kind of wellness program. About 35% of small employers do. Not all of them are leveraging these kinds of financial incentives, but about half are. So let's think about maybe like a third of employer health plans, you have some money on the line if you do or don't comply with various wellness requirements. But there is a growing body of evidence from a lot of different quarters that these programs essentially have not delivered what was promised, that they don't seem to actually be very good at improving people's health or lowering the health spending for them. And there is a lot of concern that they may turn out to be somewhat discriminatory against people who are at risk for illness, who have disabilities or other kinds of health problems, and that what they tend to do is just heap rewards upon people who are already healthy and
already practicing healthy behavior.
So, you know, like, for example, at the New York Times, not me because I'm in the union, but managers have, there's a wellness program, and the wellness program gives you a benefit if you go running a couple of times a week. If you have like a fitness tracker and you achieve a certain number of steps, you get points, and you can use those points to buy gift cards or whatever, or to get a discount on your health insurance premium. And, you know, it turns out that like the people who run a lot love it, right? They're getting a discount, and they feel like it gives them an incentive, but they probably were going to do it anyway. And it's just like this like bonus affirmation, like, isn't this great? But if you're someone who is not a runner, you're actually paying more. And I think it's very interesting because it sort of runs counter to a lot of the core values of the Affordable Care Act. I think one of the main goals of the law was to make it so that health insurance costs the same whether you're healthy or sick, to try to make it so that people who have pre-existing health conditions get the same kind of access. And I think this pulls a little bit in the opposite direction. I'm sure there will continue to be more research on it, and maybe some benefits will become more clear. There's some sense that really well-targeted programs, for example, programs that pay people to complete smoking cessation programs, seem to actually reduce smoking in that population. So it may be that there are ways to do it that are really effective and that are valuable, but the kind of way that they've been broadly adopted, the sort of blunt wellness programs, it seems are not doing as well as we had hoped.
And yet there's a huge wellness industry.
But there's also privacy concerns. I mean, that it's giving employers, you know, there's a debate about how much, who sees what, but there are concerns about your personal health data and your personal health status.
Yeah, because typically the way that employers run these programs is they're not run by the health insurance companies themselves. They tend to be run by outside vendors, third-party vendors, and those companies are not always subject to the same kinds of privacy requirements that healthcare providers and that health insurers are. And so there's been some good reporting actually here at Kaiser Health News and some other places about that data essentially being aggregated and sold with other kinds of commercial data, like your, you know, internet browsing history, your voter file and other things.
Yeah,
and
you wonder why you get these ads on Facebook.
Well, those health reports, we get lots of weird ads because we Google weird things, right?
Yes, Facebook seemed to think that I am pregnant.
Margo, do we have anything?
I am not pregnant.
And we're trying to go through. I got a lot of questions in, but I have one tiny N of one being me, because like these incentives can do really funny things to you, right? So Politico is in a building in Roslyn. Most of us work in a building in Roslyn where there's a gym, and they used to subsidize the gym for those of us who worked in that building, and we paid $30 a month. And I used to go like 3 or 4 mornings a week. Then the gym changed management several times. It's now free, right? I don't have to pay anything, and I never go. So there's some, I mean, I exercise, but not there. So like, I can't quite, all I can do is, it's just my idiosyncratic experience, but incentives aren't always
what you think,
giving the behavior that you think. So I can't even explain why I don't go when it's free. I mean, part of it is the school bus schedule, but we won't go into that. But but things change when your kid starts to drive. But no, it's not. There's still no reason I shouldn't be taking care of this totally free gym, and I don't.
Although I think that's the classic skin.
I pay to go somewhere else.
That's the classic skin in the game, though, which is that if you're paying for something, you're more likely to use it.
Okay.
Anyway, all right, I think we have time to squeeze in two more, and they're related. They're also on the how we pay for healthcare front. The first question is from Chris Cahill. He's a pediatric hospitalist in San Jose, California. He wants to know why the median pay for those who treat children, like him, is substantially lower than for those who treat adults, and more broadly, quote, who decides how much to pay any doctor for the procedures and medical work that she does. Meanwhile, Joe Felice from Liberty Lake, Washington, wants to know, quote, what is being discussed to address one of the obvious problems with U.S. healthcare costs, the fact that U.S. doctors get paid too much relative to those in other developed countries. So, which is funny because when I sort of went to Google this, you know, sort of why do pediatricians get paid less than people who treat adults, the related Google searches were, why do doctors in the U.S. get paid too much? So obviously Google thinks this is related too. who wants to start on physician pay inequities within and around the world?
I don't know the answer to why, like, a pediatric cardiologist is paid less than an adult cardiologist. In some ways, these are really complicated, requiring more specialization because it's rarer and you need more training, and they tend to be complex cases. So I don't know, and I don't approve of it.
I think he's talking about pediatric generalists.
Regular pediatricians are considered primary care, so primary care physicians make less money as a rule than specialists. On that, on the things like a pediatric surgeon or a pediatric cardiologist, I don't know, and it doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I think part of the reason is actually has to do with who has what kinds of insurance in this country. So a very large percentage of American children are insured through the Medicaid program or the CHIP program. And then as you get older, in your working age years, you're more likely to have employer insurance. And then when you reach 65, you're more likely to have Medicare. And so what happens is that if you're a doctor that treats a lot of kids, a very large percentage of your patients are going to pay you with Medicaid. This is not true in every case, but in general, Medicaid tends to pay doctors lower prices for the same services than other kinds of insurance. Commercial insurance tends to pay the best. Medicare tends to pay something somewhere in the middle.
In between.
And so I think what is happening, I mean, there are a couple of other reasons why pediatricians may make a little bit less, but I think that's the main reason, is that pediatricians just have a lot of patients who have Medicaid. Medicaid is not a very generous payer, whereas if you're, say, an adult cardiologist, you have a lot of Medicare patients. Medicare pays better than Medicaid. And if you are a specialist where you get a lot of working age people, like maybe you're an orthopedist, so you have some old people who need, break their hips, but you also have some kind of middle-aged people who need hip and knee replacements, then you're really in the sweet spot where you're getting a lot of commercial and some Medicare. You get paid a little bit more.
Orthopedists make a lot of money.
Yeah. But the other thing is that, the way that people get paid for medical care is based on, like, the stuff that you do. And pediatricians in general spend more time talking to their patients. It's more office visits. It's harder to communicate with kids and figure out what's going on with them. It's a little bit less procedural, I think, in general. Even in the subspecialties, I think it's a little bit less procedural than similar specialties for doctors. So for adult doctors. So it's a combination of things.
There's also a panel, AMA-affiliated panel, that gives recommendations for what doctors should be paid, and it's dominated by specialists. Not quite as much as it was a few years ago, but it is still dominated by specialists. And that is one reason that specialists have been paid more than primary care doctors. As Margot said, I mean, we talk a lot about the gap between primary care pay and specialty pay, but as Margot was getting at, it's what doctors would call proceduralists versus
It's doctors
who do stuff.
Exactly.
It's procedural versus cognitive, which is sort of a mouthful of a phrase. But it's the doctor who does something to you, or with your permission, or the doctor who talks to you maybe about why not to do that. And a really good example is feeding tubes in people with dementia. A gastroenterologist, I looked it up, I mean, to the extent that this, whatever I found last night is accurate, or the day before, putting in a feeding tube, doctors make like between $1,500 and like $2,500. And it's not a very long, complicated procedure. They can do a whole bunch of them in one day. Boom, 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 boom. So they can make a lot of money by doing that. To sit down and talk to a family about why their elderly patient with relative with advanced dementia shouldn't have a feeding tube, because there's a lot of things in medicine that are ambiguous or we're not so sure about. But there's just a ton of research in the last 10 years saying this is not prolonged life. It doesn't make them live longer, and it doesn't make them have a better quality of life. We're still putting them in. We're putting in less, but we're putting them in. The doctor, that same surgeon, the gastroenterologist who could make $1,500 or $3,000 by putting it in, if he was going to sit down and have he or she, but in gastroenterology, more a he, was going to sit down and have an hour-long conversation with the family about sort of emotionally difficult and hard to understand why isn't this good for grandma. They'd make like $125 or $200. So we're paying for all. So it's not only are some doctors getting paid more for things that we shouldn't really be doing so much of. We're paying for the wrong stuff. We're rewarding the wrong things. Not 100%. If you need brain surgery, you know, you need a well-compensated brain surgeon. But you know, we don't pay for the time it takes to figure out what patients want and need. We don't value that.
And we do pay our doctors, even the ones who we underpay compared to what they do. We do pay our doctors a lot more than most other developed countries do. Again, that's mostly because we don't have a really, you know, robust system of how we pay anybody in healthcare, to wit. We had just talked about drug prices.
Well, and don't doctors say, too, a lot of that is sort of legal liability? I mean, they have huge insurance for their own insurance against sort of malpractice that they claim in the U.S. is worse than any other country. And so they need to
even when you
more.
Look at all, so
we pay more for everything. It's not just that we pay more for hospitals. We pay more for MRIs, except I think maybe Japan. We pay more for everything. We pay more for our medicine, a lot more for our medicine. So you could argue that we're paying doctors too much because the European countries don't. But you can make that same case. I mean, healthcare in America costs more, partly because we just pay more.
I would say, but also the end of that is that doctor pay isn't what's driving how much
one
we pay
of
for
many
healthcare.
Factors, yeah. Right.
And it's probably not even that big
a
one.
You know, like the dentistry thing, I think a lot of it is historical and cultural in this country relative to other countries. I think there are countries in Europe where being a doctor is kind of, you're like a middle class professional, like being a school teacher, right? You know, you're seen as an expert, you work your job, you're treated with respect. But in the U.S., we have this history of a doctor as like this very elevated, high status, you know, high regard, high trust kind of profession that doctors are expected to make a lot of money. And, you know, that feels appropriate. And, of course, it the fact that doctors in the U.S. make a lot of money relative to other kinds of professionals does influence who chooses to go into medicine versus other professions, you know. If we paid doctors less, that would change who would choose medicine relative to other careers.
But if you were to ask me just off the top of my head outside of this particular room, you know, who's got that big salaries in America, I would say something in financial services. I wouldn't say doctors. It's not what would come to my mind first.
But that's not what people necessarily think.
Right.
I mean, you'd be correct.
Right.
Clearly.
It's like if you think like wacko in compensation, I think, you know, hedge fund. I don't think my pediatrician, who I like a lot.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for questions. Thank
my
you.
My child's pediatrician. Right?
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Thank you, everyone who sent them. Now it's time for our extra credit segment. That's where we each suggest a story we read the past week we think others should read, too. Don't worry if you miss it. We will post the links to these stories on the podcast page at khn.org. Who wants to go first this week? Anna.
Mine is from Vox by German Lopez. It's Republicans claimed Medicaid made the opioid epidemic worse. A new study proves them wrong. So back in January, Senator Ron Johnson had said that Medicaid expansion, which happened under Obamacare for states that chose to do it, was giving people more access to opioids because their health care was covered. And so more people were becoming addicted to opioids because of the expansion. And this was something that kind of took off and that Republicans have been claiming. And so this study took a look at five states and found that they did not, you know, the number of opioids dispensed in expansion states versus non-expansion states did not significantly differ. What was different was there was an increase in the addiction treatment that patients in expansion states were getting. There was an increase because they were covered. So they were getting buprenorphine and naloxone at an increased rate compared to the non-expansion states just sort of stayed steady.
Joanne.
There's a piece in the Virginian Pilot by an investigative reporter named Gary Harkey, and it's really pretty stunning. It's called Jailed in Crisis, Horrific Deaths, Brutal Treatment, Mental Illness in America's Jails. It's very disturbing to read. There's video that's very disturbing to watch. But the you know, we know that our jails are full of people with mental illness who may have only ended up there because there's no other place to treat them, or their behavior became criminal because they weren't in treatment. And not only are they not getting great care in many of America's jails and prisons, they're dying. You know, they documented hundreds of deaths around the country. And these are not gentle into the night deaths. It's a really good piece.
Margo.
I wanted to recommend a piece from my colleague Aaron Carroll at The Upshot. He's also a researcher
and a pediatrician.
Yeah, at the University of Indiana. But
sort of a comedian.
And he had a piece. There was an article in The Lancet last week looking at the sort of a big meta-analysis of the risks of alcohol consumption across the world that was trying to sort of look at what is a healthy level of alcohol consumption, what are the risks associated with alcohol consumption. And the big headline that came out of most of the articles that I read about that study when it came out was that there is no safe level of alcohol consumption, that the kind of traditional thinking that there was a benefit to moderate alcohol consumption is wrong, and that all alcohol is dangerous and increases your risk of death. And so Aaron's article is called Study Causes Splash, But Why You Should Stay Calm on Alcohol's Risks. And it's sort of a classic of what Aaron does, which is he looks past that kind of new nugget that seemed to get the attention of a lot of reporters and really looks at, like, okay, well, like, how risky is moderate drinking? How seriously should we all consider just avoiding alcohol altogether? And what he finds, and this is looking at the very same study, which, you know, there also are some reasons why you might have some quibbles with the research on this, because a lot of nutritional research, it's all kind of observational, and there are lots of confounding factors that make it hard to tease out real effects. But he says even if you kind of take this data at its word, the increased risk to your health of drinking one or even two drinks a day is extremely small. So there is some risk. And if you want to avoid, you know, all risk of death, then, you know, don't drink alcohol and don't do lots of other things like cross the street. But that the sense that there's no safe level of alcohol is probably overstating the risk. And if you want to drink moderately occasionally because it gives you pleasure or you think it's delicious or it's part of your religious tradition, that you don't have to worry that you're suddenly going to keel over and die.
Well, my story is also from the New York Times, and it's called Scotland to Provide Free Sanitary Products to Students by Ceylan Yiginsu. And the story is just what the headline says. Scotland is going to, starting next month, provide, quote, essential sanitary products, close quote, to all female students at every level, about 400,000 of them, at a cost of about $6.5 million a year U.S. The goal is to prevent girls and women from missing educational opportunities because they can't afford their monthly supplies. And this is a real problem. It has launched a big debate all around the U.K., not just in Scotland. Some people are arguing it should be extended to all low-income women. And the argument that broke out when it was proposed that that be paid for with a tax on sanitary products themselves suggested that only women should pay for other women caused a bit of a fight. It is an argument that's mostly not being had in the U.S., although there have been some arguments about taxes and the equity of those taxes. But it probably will be soon, which is why I wanted to highlight it. So that is our show for this week. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd also appreciate it if you left us a review on iTunes. That helps other people find us too. Also, as usual, you can email us your questions or comments. We're at whatthehealth, all one word, at kff.org, or you can tweet me. I'm at Jay Rovner.
At Anna Edney.
At Joanne Kennan.
At Sanger Katz.
We'll be back in your feed next week. In the meantime, be healthy.